from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, a sociologist explores why we allow so many people in the United States to live in poverty. Then we learn some tips to prepare for winter emergencies.
Emergency plans really should focus on what you're going to do if it's unsafe to leave the house or if it's unsafe to stay in the house.
We'll find out if there's really a rivalry between Fleet Farm and Farm and Fleet.
That myth has been persistent in Wisconsin for the 6 or 7 decades that those stores have been around.
And finally, we'll learn what holiday movies can teach us about handling stressful situations during the season.
Oftentimes, when we go back home to spend the holidays with our families, it's almost like we become 10 years old again.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for joining us. Why does poverty persist in the United States, the richest country in the world? Sociologist Matthew Desmond argues it's because everyone else benefits from it. Not just the wealthiest Americans, but those who are housed, college-educated, and secure. His book, Poverty by America, explores why so many in the U.S. live in poverty and how to end it. Desmond attended graduate school at UW-Madison and won the Pulitzer Prize for his 2016 book, Evicted, which looks at housing and poverty here in Milwaukee. He talks about his latest book with WUWM's Lena Tran.
Many listeners will be familiar with your work from Evicted, you know, and so I guess reading this, it is really different. And I was wondering what the through line is here, how you got from that very zoomed in look at housing and poverty to casting this huge wide look at just about everything else.
I have been researching and reporting on poverty all of my adult life, basically. You know, I've lived in really poor communities. I've spoken to organizers and union reps and spent time with folks that are part of the working homeless and studied statistics and taught classes and, you know, but I didn't feel like I really had a solid answer to a core question. Like if someone came up to me on the street and said, Matt, why is there so much poverty in America and how can we finally end it? What would it be my answer? And this book is my answer.
And you land on a pretty clear and damning answer, which is that the reason poverty is so persistent in our country is because those who are better off benefit from it. How do people who aren't living in poverty benefit?
We permit unrelenting exploitation of the poor in the labor market, in the housing market, in the financial market. So we allow workers to be really shortchanged, and we allow millions of folks to work for poverty wages. And who benefits from that? Corporations do, sure, but so do many of us that consume the cheap goods and services that the working poor produce. So do many of us who are invested in the stock market. You know, don't we benefit a bit when we see our savings go up, even if that requires a kind of a human sacrifice? We protect tax breaks that really are designed to subsidize affluence and not alleviate poverty. We protect things like the mortgage interest deduction or tax breaks for wealth transfers or retirement plans. And a lot of those tax breaks really accrue to the richest families in America, and that starves anti-poverty spending. And then many of us continue to embrace segregation. You know, we build walls around our communities through zoning laws, and we hoard opportunity behind those walls. We have to begin tearing down the walls, and I think we have to start taking steps as a country to finally abolish poverty.
Early on in the book, you tell this story of your friend Wu, who you met while you were living in Milwaukee, and he has this awful experience that is actually pretty common for people living in poverty. Could you share that story?
Sure. Wu and I lived together in a rooming house on the north side of Milwaukee, and he stepped on a nail there once, and he ignored the infection that started spreading. He just couldn't afford to pay it any mind. He worked all the time as a security guard. And pretty soon the infection accelerated, and it was accelerated by his diabetes, and he had his leg amputated. And traumatic, of course. You know, Wu was just a gregarious man. He's also a very big man, and I found him in the hospital. And just, he looked small, and we cried together. And then we applied for disability together for him, and he got rejected. And then he hired a lawyer, and the lawyer won the case, who got, I think, $3,400 in back pay, and the lawyer took home $400. Now, that never really bothered Wu. You know, he thought, you know, that's how he was able to get on disability. But, you know, I can't get over the fact that over $1 billion every year in Social Security funds doesn't go to people like Wu. It goes to lawyers to help people like Wu get on disability. And this is a big theme in America, where a lot of money that's earmarked for low-income folks never reaches them.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. You know, it is this one story, but it's one of the many ways that, by and large, money set aside for anti-poverty programs doesn't really reach the people who need it.
Right. So that's another thing that really blew me away researching the book. We hear so much about welfare dependency. We heard so much about it in COVID. But if you look at the data, you quickly realize the problem isn't welfare dependency, it's welfare avoidance. There's so many families in America that are leaving a lot of aid on the table. And if you add up like the amount of aid that goes unused by 1 in 5 workers who could receive the earned income tax credit, which is like a wage subsidy for working parents, 1 in 5 workers don't claim it. 1 in 5 elderly Americans who could receive food stamps don't claim them. And you add that up with the folks that pass on unemployment insurance and government health insurance and, you know, things like that, you realize that every year, you know, over $140 billion, billion with a B, is left on the table. This is frankly the opposite of welfare dependence. And we might be like, what's going on? Is it stigma? Are people not reaching for programs that they need and deserve because they're embarrassed? And the answer seems to be not really, actually. There's some mixed evidence for that. There's more evidence for the fact that we've made these programs hard to apply for, onerous. We made it confusing, difficult. And so very simple steps like making the font bigger, helping elderly folks apply for food stamps, directly saying, hey, you know, you can apply for this. Did you know this? Sign up now. Really, really can work. And, you know, we live in a country where with a click of a button, we can have just about anything delivered to our door the next day, right? We know how to advertise. We know how to deliver things. Apply those skills and that know-how to helping families get connected to programs they need and deserve.
Mm-hmm. So you've just talked about ways that we could make it easier for people to access this money that is already earmarked for, you know, anti-poverty measures. Could you take some time to talk about your other solutions?
I think we need to do 3 things to end poverty in America. And I want to focus on the ending part. I do not want to reduce poverty. I want to abolish it. And a country as rich as ours certainly can afford to do so. The first thing we need to do is deepen our investments in anti-poverty spending. And it's not really hard to know where the money would come from. You know, a recently published study showed that if the top 1% of us just paid the taxes they owed, we could raise an additional $175 billion every year. That's almost enough to lift everyone out of poverty. We know how to do this. But we don't just need deeper investments, we need different ones. You know, we need to attack the unrelenting exploitation of poor folks. You know, consider the labor market. There was a time where if you got a job, you could advance in the company, you got some benefits, your wages went up every year. We are so far away from that today. And a reason is because workers have lost power. And so we need to find ways of empowering the poor, expanding their choice, especially with respect to where to live and how to bank. And then the third thing we need to do is finally end our embrace of segregation. We need to tear down the walls that we've created around our communities and really strive for inclusive communities based on broad prosperity. With those 3 steps, I think we could finally abolish poverty in this rich nation.
Throughout this book, you use the language of we and us, like, you know, the reader is going to be someone with a 401k, you know, but also you're with us. Can you talk about the discomfort of seeing yourself implicated in that system and maybe how to channel that into something productive, like becoming a quote-unquote poverty abolitionist?
This is going to take all of us. And I really thought about that. I'm so glad you brought this up. I really struggled with that language, the language of the book, because you're right. When you use this word, you're like, who is the we, right? Who's the book targeted toward? And at the very beginning of the book, I say the we is, the lucky, the college educated, the housed, the protected. And, I grew up poor. My family went through foreclosure process before everyone else was doing it, and I have, a social mobility story like many Americans. And I think it's important for those of us that have found some security to ask ourselves how we are connected to the problem and thus connected to the solution. So I do think that means doing things like examining our consumer choices, looking at our investment portfolios, demanding more of our government. I think that as a homeowner, I own a home now, so I'm eligible for the mortgage interest deduction, for example. I don't want this deduction. I don't need it. Many folks that are taking this giant benefit from the government, a benefit that far, far outpaces direct housing assistance to the needy. We don't need that. And so I think the more of us that can speak out against this imbalanced tax system or welfare state that benefits many of us, the more that we can kind of rethink our consumer choices and our investment decisions, not only because those individual decisions are important, but also because it can really change the common sense and push the political will. And also, I think we have to invest in broad prosperity. And so that sounds abstract, right? Like, what does that mean? But often it means going down to your zoning board meeting on a Tuesday night and standing up and saying, look, I refuse to be a segregationist. I refuse to deny other kids opportunity. My kids have had living in this neighborhood, build this thing. So I think that this isn't an argument that is designed to spur guilt. It's an argument designed to spur action and inspire us to reach for something better.
What makes you hopeful that we can make progress on what you're offering us, that we won't stay siloed behind the walls that we have risen?
I'm hopeful because we have so many resources in this country, and we just have to push back against any suggestion otherwise. I think anytime we hear this idea, like, man, how are we going to afford that? We just have to reject that dishonest, even sinful question. We certainly have the resources to make major differences. Like, look at what happened in COVID, right? Like, we reduced child poverty almost in half in just 6 months. 6 months. And so we have the resources, we have the know-how. That gives me hope.
Matthew Desmond is a sociology professor at Princeton University and the author of Poverty by America. He spoke with WUWM's Lena Tran last year. Did you know you can listen to Like Effect as a podcast? Just search for Like Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen to us on demand. Coming up in the show, we revisit some classic holiday movies and see what lessons we can learn from them. But first, with the cold weather settling in, we talk to experts about how to prepare for winter storms and power outages. That's coming up on Lake Effect on WUWM. You're listening to Like Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. After a mild start to the winter, we're now starting to feel the chill. How do you prepare for winter emergencies, like power outages and snowstorms? Lake Effect's expert Nunez speaks with Andrew Beckett from Ready Wisconsin and Jen Warren from the Red Cross to learn how people can prepare themselves for winter.
Jen, I want to start off by asking, what are some terms people should become familiar with in preparation for a winter storm? So, for instance, what's the difference between a winter storm warning versus a winter storm watch?
I think it's important to know the difference between both of those so that you know how long that you have to prepare. So a winter storm warning means that life-threatening or severe winter weather conditions have begun or will begin within 24 hours. A winter storm watch means winter storm conditions are possible within the next 36 to 48 hours.
And so, Andrew, I want to ask, before a winter storm arrives, what are some supplies people should have on hand to take care of themselves and anyone else at home?
Well, you really want to look at having kits in both your home and your vehicle if you could potentially be on the road really at any time during the winter. And we'll start with kits at home. You know, kits at home really should include things like having a supply of at least, 72 hours of non-perishable food, preferably something that doesn't require having to be cooked, so that if you were to lose power or natural gas service, you're able to make sure that everybody in your home remains fed. You also want to make sure that you have a supply of water for everyone who's living in your home. The standard is really about a gallon of water per person in your home per day for both hygiene and cooking and eating purposes. In addition to that, items such as flashlights, extra batteries, having a battery operated or at least battery backup NOAA weather radio so that you can get critical alerts and updates, making sure that you know where things like extra supplies of medication might be located, whether they're in a kit itself or if you keep them somewhere else in the home. And really, those are kind of some of the essential supplies. But, it also comes with having a plan for what you're going to do in the event that the worst does happen and you lose power and you're not expected to get it back for a significant amount of time, or your furnace goes out in your home, what steps you're going to take in order to make sure that everybody stays safe. In vehicles, kits should include some of those things like some snacks, blankets, jumper cables. Make sure you have a good snow scraper in your vehicle, a cell phone charger, kitty litter in case you get stuck somewhere for a little bit of extra traction. If you have room in the trunk, a snow shovel is a good thing to keep on you. Extra hats and gloves. And then just also making sure that you know what to do if you were to get stuck and who to call for help so that you can hopefully get out of there as quickly as possible or have somebody take you to safety.
You touched on a great list of supplies that you might need and come in handy. What if you have to take care of your pets during a situation like this? What are some supplies you should have prepared to take care of your pets?
Well, pets, have many of the same needs as people. They're going to need water. They're going to need extra food to make sure that you have enough on hand, just in case you were to get stuck at home for a few days while the plows dig things out. You also want to make sure that if they have medications, those are on hand. And then also, if they're pets that may necessarily need to stay outside, that they have access to shelter, they have access to fresh water in a source that isn't going to freeze, whether that's some sort of heated source or you're able to constantly make sure that they have access to it. Of course, with those pets, in the cold and snow, if you're able to bring them indoors, that's great. You should really look to do that.
Right. And Andrew, you mentioned this earlier, too. I also noticed Ready Wisconsin recommends people and families make an emergency plan ahead of the winter storm. What does an emergency plan look like?
Well, emergency plans really should focus on what you're going to do if it's unsafe to leave the house or if it's unsafe to stay in the house. And really, we'll look at it from those two ways. If you are unable to leave the house, you need to make sure that you have that plan, including things like having that emergency kit stocked up, making sure that that's done in advance, making sure that you have those essential contact numbers on hand, whether it's going to be, emergency furnace repair, calling a contact number for the power company in case you do lose service and you need to contact them in order to make sure that, they're aware that you are out and you're on their list for places to get repaired. But also, in case it is unsafe to stay home, identifying where you're going to go, whether that's going to be potentially shelters that are available in your area, other members of your family, basically knowing how you're safely going to be able to stay somewhere else if it's not safe to stay at home.
Okay, so let's say the winter storms arrived and someone's been outside for too long. Jen, I want to ask you, what are some of the telltale signs of hypothermia and frostbite, and is this preventable?
Sure. So shivering is one of the first signs of hypothermia. Other signs can include confusion, drowsiness, and slurred speech. For frostbite, your nose, ears, cheeks, chin, fingers, and toes are often the first affected. People might experience pain, numbness, and a change of skin color. In terms of what people can do for hypothermia, seek emergency medical care right away. move to a warm place and remove any wet clothing and warm the body slowly. For frostbite, move to a warm place, warm the affected area gently by soaking it in warm water, not hot water, until the skin appears normal and then feels warm, and then seek emergency medical care.
And so, Andrew, you mentioned this earlier too, you know, what is a plan if you're at home and your power goes out? What should someone do in that situation?
Well, really the first thing that you should do if you lose power at home is to make sure that you've contacted your utility provider to let them know, because they're the ones who are going to be able to address that outage. They're the ones who are going to give you an update on what possible restoration times are and if there's any specific concerns you need to be worried about. Typically speaking, with power outages, there's usually something that's happened to a main line somewhere, but you also want to be aware of any damage that might have occurred on your property. Usually with the connection between your house and where the service comes into it, some of these winter storms, we see heavy snow and ice on trees. They can drop limbs on lines. If they cause any damage to the infrastructure that actually connects the power to your house, you might have to additionally look at getting something like an electrician out in order to fix that last bit of service to make sure that the connection to the house is restored. If you have the ability to have a generator installed, you know, that is something that many people can look out, especially if they might be in more rural areas or areas where they feel like, you know, they lose power a lot and they want to have a solution there. It's very important with generators, though, that they're being operated and installed properly. You know, especially standalone generators need to be at least 20 feet away from your home. Make sure they're vented properly so that there's not that risk of carbon monoxide poisoning from having them operating. They should never be run inside an enclosed space, even inside like your garage, because there is a potential danger with those that can, you know, very quickly become deadly if they're not used properly. So really, if you do decide to use a generator, make sure that it's being installed by a professional who knows what they're doing and that it's being operated properly and tested regularly so that when you need it, you know that it's going to operate properly.
Right. And in situations like these, people might need shelter to turn to. Where might people find shelter if they need it? Or what are some resources people can turn to?
Shelter information is going to vary widely based on where you live. Some municipalities may set up warming centers. They may work with organizations like the Red Cross or other volunteer organizations to set up shelter operations overnight if conditions really warrant it and they see a demand for having that resource available. So really the best resource that an individual might need to look at is local government websites, social media accounts, because typically speaking, if they open warming centers or overnight shelters, they're going to post that information in a public place where people can hopefully see it. And then they're going to also send that information out to local media in order to help publicize it. So really, one of the first places that people should be looking is to their local government to see what information is being shared out there. A number of counties do also utilize 211 during periods of severe weather in order to help collect information, but also to share information with residents. So if you do have 211 available in your area, which should be in most counties in the state, you can contact there and they should be able to at least point you in the right direction for additional resources.
Well, Jen and Andrew, thank you both so much for speaking with me today and sharing this helpful advice.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having me.
Andrew Beckett is a public information officer for Wisconsin Emergency Management and leads the state's Ready Wisconsin campaign. Jen Warren is the regional communications director for the American Red Cross Wisconsin. They both joined Lake Effect's Expert Nunez last January. Fleet Farm and Farm & Fleet are among the most beloved brands from Wisconsin, and with good reason. Where else can you buy an enormous bag of circus peanuts, a new pair of jeans, and a baby chick all at the same time? But there is a persistent myth plaguing the legacy of these two stores, one that frames them as dueling brands forever locked in a battle for dominance. So we're here to set the record straight with Archer Parkett, managing editor of Milwaukee Magazine, who wrote a story about the origins of the brands and spoke to Like Effect's Joy Powers about it.
Starting into this story, it reminded me a lot of a story I did a while back on the origins of the word bubbler. Similarly, there's this persistent myth, in the case of the bubbler, that Kohler invented the term when someone there designed a drinking fountain. But the whole thing is bunk. There are no records of this supposed designer, and Kohler wasn't even doing plumbing at the time. Yet you'll still hear people repeating this claim and really sticking to it. What I found fascinating about Farm and Fleet, or Fleet Farm, they have a very similar legend with that same kind of allegiance. Can you explain a bit about that?
Yes, definitely. I think that's a great example of the bubbler story. What really makes the legend interesting is how devoted people are to it. So there are different versions of the legend, but the most common that I've heard is that Fleet Farm and Farm and Fleet originated with two different brothers, or at least distant relatives, and that they had both started it together, started it for a few years, and then had some sort of big feud that maybe it was over a girl they both liked, or they had different ideas about the business. And they got in such a big fight that they split it up. There was some legal action involved, and they had to branch out into different parts of Wisconsin and change their name. So that's why we have such similar names, Fleet Farm and Farm and Fleet. The other version of the legend that's most common is that it was a couple who started it, and that the couple divorced, and that they had to split the store in the divorce settlement and had that same name change thing in the end. That myth has been persistent in Wisconsin for the 6 or 7 decades that those stores have been around.
It seems like regardless of the relationship at the center of it, there is this idea that there was this big rupture that caused the branching off of these competing farm and fleets and or fleet farms. The actual story has a lot more to do with tax law than I'd anticipated, but it does include brothers, two sets of them, in fact. How do we come to have this dueling, as it were, farm and fleet and fleet farm?
Yeah, the actual story, strangely enough, the two franchises are quite parallel. Both franchises started in 1955. Two sets of brothers, Bert and Claude Blaine and Stu and Hank Mills. The Blaine brothers, they were in their middle age at the time. They owned car dealerships throughout Wisconsin. And the Mills brothers were much younger. I believe they were in their 20s. They were the sons of Stuart Mills, who had his own auto company as well, selling cars. So what happened in the 50s were there were these very stringent minimum markup laws in Wisconsin. We still have some of those laws, but they're not nearly as strict as they were back then. So back then, retailers could not sell things at much of a discount at all. It was considered unfair. They all had to mark things at the same price. One of the only exceptions was for customers who owned a fleet, which meant that they had 5 or more internal combustion engines. So the way that was defined, it could be cars, tractors, even a couple of lawnmowers counted. So at the time, the people who had that many engines in Wisconsin were farmers. And so both the Mills and the Blaine brothers realized that they could get around these markup laws by focusing on the people who had fleet cards, farmers. So what they both did was they started their own stores. The Mills brothers started in Marshfield and the Blaine brothers started in Janesville. Their goal was to sell farm supplies to people with fleet cards. So they were offering these goods at just prices way better than a normal store could offer. And it really was sort of a genius idea at the time. And that's where part of the dueling aspect comes into play, is the idea of who came up with it first. Was it the Mills brothers or the Blaine brothers? And once I started to look into it, that conflict goes even further. They both joined the Mid-States Co-op, which was a group of multiple stores with the same business model, ran by a couple called Bob and Jean Kiesow. And to this day, the Mid-States Co-op claims they came up with the idea. So the Mills brothers, the Blaine brothers, and the co-op all sort of at this point lay claim to having come up with the idea originally. But yeah, in 1955, they both started their first store selling to folks with fleet cards.
It's interesting that there are these two sets of brothers who have started stores. There isn't that kind of rupture at the center. And what I found even more interesting is they weren't the only fighting fleet farmers, as it were. There were a variety of them in the state. Do you have any idea how many there were?
There were dozens pushing 70 to 80 around the Midwest in that late 50s, early 60s time. Because it was just such a great idea because there was no other way to market these discount goods at the time. But yeah, I looked up some of the old documents about some of these places. There was Farm and Fleet Field Service, Quality Farm and Fleet Supply, Dinsmore Farm and Fleet, Steve's Farm and Fleet. They were all over. It was not just the two that have grown into the sort of Wisconsin behemoths.
Well, and that really gets to what they are now. They are these kinds of behemoths. They may have had these, you know, I don't know if you would even call them humble origins, because both of these sets of brothers came from relatively well-off families. But they are, in many ways, the last remaining Fleet Farm ventures, as it were. Perhaps even more oddly, even though they were competing, it seems like they had a friendly relationship.
Yes, actually. I spoke to some of the folks who still work at those stores. Unfortunately, both sets of brothers have passed on since then. But yeah, everyone reports friendly relations between the families. There's really no one who says that there was any rivalry outside of, you know, the basics of business. In fact, some of the folks who knew the brothers told me that like Bert and Stu Mills were actually pretty good friends. The personal aspect of the rivalry really does not have any basis in reality that I could tell.
Now here's, I think, the final question. Do you think Wisconsinites are ready for the real story of Farm and Fleet / Fleet Farm?
You know, I don't know, because the real story is just not quite as fun as the fake one. My favorite part of the story was talking to people from the stores and just hearing how often people would tell them their version of the legend and insist that it was real. Even people who knew the original brothers, who had been there for decades, would have customers who just would not listen and insist that it was this personal split. I think it's just a great story. It's very unique that we have these similarly named stores that are so well-loved and have such strong fan bases. And I think the fact that there's this legend adds a whole another layer to it, and the reality's a little bit less fun. But yeah, I think once people learn the real story, it actually is kind of interesting in its own way. The way it developed out of these legal loopholes and the way they've grown their business and become this real cultural Wisconsin touchstone, I think.
For sure. Well, Archer, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Great, thank you.
Archer Parkett is the managing editor of Milwaukee Magazine. He joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers in 2022. A new season of Bulber Talk is underway, but we still need some new questions. Submit whatever questions you have about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. The holidays can be stressful. Coming up next, we'll talk to a psychologist about how to face those challenges. Keep listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The holiday season can be full of cheer, but it can also bring unnecessary stress. Whether it be from the pressure to get the perfect gift, those last-minute changes of plans, or a dysfunctional family dynamic, the holidays are not always easy to navigate. Many holiday movies reflect these sources of December stress and offer insight on how to and how not to navigate them. Dr. Lynn Knobloch-Fetters is a licensed clinical psychologist, an associate professor at Marquette University, and a movie buff. She spoke with Lake Effect's Sam Woods to offer tips on how to manage common causes of holiday stress using situations from holiday movies.
Our first movie is an absolute classic, Home Alone. So for those who aren't familiar, Kevin, the main character played by Macaulay Culkin, is left home alone by mistake as the rest of his family rushes to catch a flight during the holidays.
How could we do this? We forgot him.
We didn't forget him. We just miscounted.
What kind of mother am I?
If it makes you feel any better, I forgot my reading glasses.
Now, during the holiday season, there's so much to do with so little time that we tend to forget to focus on the important things. Maybe not, you know, leaving our children behind as we go on vacation kind of important things, but those little things kind of get in the way of realizing and focusing on the important things during the season. Dr. Knobloch-Fetters, can you talk about how to manage the overwhelming feeling of just so much to do, so little time during the holidays?
Yes, I think it's important to keep in mind why we're celebrating the holidays. We're celebrating them to bring our family and friends together, to spread peace and love and joy in the holiday season. And sometimes those minute details can just take over our lives and give us this frustration, this irritation, this overwhelming sense of being overcome by things that are really small when you take a step back. And so I would like to encourage people to take a pause and focus on the things that are most important to them during the holiday season, special times or experiences that you want to lead the way in your holiday celebration. And when you can focus on those really important moments, the rest of the smaller details seem to fade in importance.
Do you have any tips for someone who, you know, can recognize this, that like, hey, I've got a lot to do in a little bit of time and it's stressing me out, but I want to focus on the more important things, but I just don't feel like I can? Is there any way that someone in that position can kind of work through that?
Our human tendency is just to rush even faster and do even more. But when I work with people, I let them know that if they slow down and really take care of themselves and give themselves some calming time, even take some deep breaths, go for a walk, have some peaceful time, actually, they're better able to manage the stress and they will end up being more productive and feel more fulfilled in the end. So it's kind of this dialectic where we want to rush to get things done, and yet that is the opposite of what will help us feel we have accomplished things that we are proud of.
In a Rush to Get Things Done is a good segue into our next film, which is Jingle All the Way. So this is another 90s film. It focuses on the main character, Howard, who's a workaholic husband, and he wants to make up for neglecting his family in lieu of work for, the whole year. And he knows his son wants the hot new toy, a Turbo Man. And Howard, played by Arnold Schwarzenegger, goes to extreme lengths to get the perfect gift.
Hey, everybody! These two are looking for a Turbo Man!
Shut up, man!
Now, what's so funny?
Where have you guys been? Turbo Man's only the hottest selling Christmas toy ever!
And so, like Howard here, he's under a lot of pressure. He feels like he's under a lot of pressure to get the perfect gift. And so for those who celebrate Christmas and give gifts for during Christmas, you know, this is a relatable struggle. Do you have any tips for managing this pressure of getting that perfect gift?
I love that you brought up this movie Jingle All the Way, because I think it's a perfect illustration of focusing on the meaning behind gift giving. So Howard is so focused on buying the special toy for his son, but meanwhile, his family and his son just want more time with him and for him to show up in the memorable experiences that they want him to be a part of. And so I would encourage people to just switch their priorities from trying to think that the perfect gift is going to be the symbol of your love in the relationship, to really thinking about expressing your love and joy and appreciation, maybe through spending more time together, having more experiences together, and less about the actual thing. Because we all know that human beings love things for about 10 minutes, and then our attention quickly turns to the next thing. And really, material things aren't as satisfying as deeper, more lasting human relationships and experiences.
I'm picking up on a theme here in the first two answers, that it's not about the commercial part or the material part. It's really like this is an opportunity to spend time with your loved ones. And so kind of focus on that. Am I reading this right?
Yes, you are completely right. You know, our society really emphasizes commercialism, and it emphasizes busyness and productivity. And during the holiday season, it's very important to try to challenge some of those societal pressures and think about the hidden, or the deeper meaning, I should say, of the whole holiday season.
Well, and spending more time together hits on a theme of our next movie, Almost Christmas. So Walter, played by Danny Glover, lost his wife earlier in the year and just wants one thing for Christmas: for his four grown children to get along together under the same roof for 5 days during the holidays. And it's what their mother would have wanted, but it proves to be a lot harder than expected.
Oh my God, you always start.
Actually, you both started it.
You know what? You stay out of it. You're just making it worse.
I'm lying now. This is exactly why I want to stay in a hotel, Pop.
Well, what's stopping you now, huh?
Nothing's stopping me. You know, I'm not going to let you dispose of myself.
Quiet.
And so navigating family conflict or dysfunction during the holidays is a common form of holiday stress. And often a lot of it feels out of the control of the person who's feeling those feelings, feeling those emotions, feeling that stress. But Dr. Knobloch-Fetters, how can people recognize that they're getting stressed out by situations like this and continue to either move from it or know that it's time to remove themselves from the situation?
Oftentimes when we go back home to spend the holidays with our families, it's almost like we become 10 years old again. And we're relating to our siblings, we're relating to our parents or grandparents in that same way as when we were kids. And those family patterns are so deeply ingrained in us that it's very easy to fall into those patterns without recognizing that you are now with more life experience, more wisdom, and more freedom to relate to your family in different ways than you were when you were 10 years old. So I would encourage people to think about common stress points or stress in relationships, and we all have family members that are difficult to get along with, but think about how would you like to treat them in a loving and gentle way, and how will you rise above the common triggers and not let them pull you under into the feeling of being 10 years old again.
I love that analogy of feeling like you're 10 years old again, because that is that I feel that it's like a kind of a new brain switches on where there's these old things that come up, these old triggers that come up. It's like, man, I haven't thought about this in years. Like, I didn't know this was still a part of me, and they come up during during the holidays or just kind of in certain situations. But Almost Christmas also hits on themes of grief, just like the next movie on our list, Christmas Checklist. And this is the newest movie on our list, and like Almost Christmas, it touches on themes of holiday grieving, but with a lot fewer siblings to fight with. The story centers on Emily, who plans to spend Christmas alone as she grieves her recently passed mother. However, when she discovers a posthumous gift from her mom, a 12 Days of Christmas checklist of self-healing holiday activities, she takes on the challenge to get out of the house for the holidays.
I think she knew I'd be heartbroken without her, so the list is her way of making me do stuff to distract me from my sadness.
Well, then there's only one thing to do. Complete every item on that list.
Grief and loss can be such a huge weight to carry during the holidays, especially recent grief and loss. You know, if this is your first holiday season without, you know, a family member that you really loved or someone in your life that you really loved, that can be a lot to hold on to and, you know, fight through to get to that holiday cheer part of the season. But Dr. Knobloch-Fetters, for people who are navigating grief and loss during this time, what would you suggest thinking about or focusing on during this time to both acknowledge that grief and that loss and those real feelings, but also, you know, maybe find a little bit in the holiday season beyond that?
I think dealing with grief and loss is incredibly challenging at any time of the year, but it's particularly difficult during the holiday season when our image of Christmases past and celebrations with loved ones who are no longer with us can really tug at your heartstrings. And sometimes that grief comes in waves, in floods that you never even expected. And so I encourage people to really find a way to honor that grief during the holiday season. Think about a tradition or a memory that you have with your loved one and do something to honor that memory. And it may not be the same tradition without that person present, but it could be your time of celebration of the relationship that you had and the person that was in your life that impacted you for the good. So I would encourage people not to rush through those feelings or pretend that they aren't there or go on like everything is okay on the outside. I would encourage them to really honor and respect their grief and be attuned with themselves and allow them to feel their feelings in a very respectful and authentic way.
You mentioned earlier in that answer, you know, the phrase Christmas Past. And I'm going to jump on that as a segue to our next movie, the oldest story in our list, A Christmas Carol. So some may know this story as just simply Scrooge or associate it with Muppets or animated Disney ducks. But in all of these versions, Scrooge is a rich, miserly, lonely man, and he's visited by four ghosts, including Jacob Marley, on Christmas Eve, including the ghost of Christmas Past, who shows Scrooge how his relentless pursuit of money made him lose out on love early in his life.
All your nobler hopes have merged into the one hope of being rich. One master passion engulfs you. Money.
What of it? Even if I've grown wiser, I've not changed towards you, have I?
In words, no. Never.
How then?
In your changed nature. In everything that made me love you.
And so I bring this movie up because the holiday season can be rife with regrets or disappointment or loneliness or stewing on old mistakes that we feel we've made or just reasons for loneliness. Dr. Knobloch-Fetters, how can people navigate these feelings of loneliness or these feelings of regret for past mistakes that Scrooge was really feeling towards the beginning of this story?
I think those feelings of loneliness or regret are good internal indicators of the kind of person that you'd like to be in the future. So the wonderful thing about being human is that we can't change the past, but we can certainly do different things in the future. So if there's regrets in your life or loneliness or disappointments that you faced, now is a great time to write a letter of apology for perhaps, or reach out to someone you've been alienated from and do your best to try to heal those ruptures in your life and move on. And I think that is the wonderful thing about being human, is that we always get a fresh start and a new chance and a new opportunity to redo things in a meaningful way.
And we'll end on a lighter note with our final movie, A Christmas Story. And so fans of this movie may remember classic lines like, you know, you'll shoot your eye out, kid. But I want to focus on the final scenes where the neighbor's dogs eat the Christmas dinner and it forces the family to change their holiday plans day of. Unlike some of these bigger emotions that we were just talking about, you know, family dysfunction, grief and loss, regret, something like this can come just out of nowhere, whether it be, you know, your flight was canceled or the neighbor's dogs eat the turkey or, you know, you burn some food, whatever it is, plans can change even during the holidays, which can also add to that holiday stress, right? So as we're heading into the holidays and as things will inevitably not go as planned, how can people manage that stress of last-minute changes day of during the holidays?
I think that sometimes we build up so many idealized fantasies in our mind about the way things should be or how things must be that we don't get fully invested in the moment. And I promise you that if the food is burned or dogs come in and take your Christmas dinner away, you will remember that for the rest of your life. And you might not remember that as much as if the meal was perfect and all went according to plan. And so those kind of comic things that are surprising or changing at the last minute might be the very things that bring your family together and allow you to laugh and reminisce in the future about how difficult that was in the moment, but how everyone got past it. And so I would encourage people to, yes, you can certainly think about your vision for how you'd like the holidays to go, but when that vision doesn't match reality, be flexible enough to go in the present moment and enjoy the experience for whatever it turns out to be.
Well, Dr. Knobloch-Fetters, thank you so much for joining me on Lake Effect and for, you know, putting it back in my brain that this holiday season is supposed to be about time spent together with loved ones, not about gifts, not about things going perfectly, but that time together, recharging from a year in community with people. And thank you for reminding us of that as we head into the holidays.
Thank you for having me. I wish everyone a blessed and joyful holiday season.
Dr. Lynn Knobloch-Fetters is a licensed clinical psychologist and associate professor at Marquette University. She spoke with Lake Effect Sam Woods last December. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we hear from the founder of Heal the Hood MKE about his plans for the program after moving out of state. That's tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.